Tuesday morning at 6:05. Good to have you here on JR Morning. Chris Renwick, Lloyd Jackson with you. And we've talked a lot about these teen takeovers here in the city of Detroit, and city officials are trying to do something about it, trying to engage the community, but that doesn't mean that they're taking the eye off the ball when it comes to more serious matters.
That is true, because over the weekend, a 14-year-old was shot, and that 14-year-old is recovering after being shot at this large downtown gathering of teens in Detroit over the weekend. It's an incident that also led police to take two other teenagers into custody. Authorities say a weapon was recovered following that late-night violence near Farmer Street and Grand River. Now, the shooting comes as the city continues to confront so-called teen takeovers, social media-driven gatherings that have at times led to curfew arrests and increased police presence. Detroit police say curfew enforcement remains in effect, with 10 p.m. for those 15 and under, 11 p.m. for older teens. Mayor Mary Sheffield says her six-point community safety plan is still in place, combining enforcement with prevention efforts like neighborhood investment, mental health services, and late-night recreation programs, but she says there will be zero tolerance for violence.
So we are going to continue to push enforcement and accountability. I want to be very clear that while this administration is creating safe spaces and investing in prevention, we equally are promoting accountability and enforcement, and we will not tolerate violence. We will not tolerate what we saw this weekend, and we will continue to push for parental responsibility enforcement in our curfew. And so it's not an either or, it's a both and we believe that our approach will continue to yield the results we want to see.
And Chris, the mayor says, you know, there are young people who actually come downtown to have a good time and enjoy downtown. But she says there are those who want to make trouble. And those people who want to come downtown and make trouble will be dealt with.
Well, they should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's the reality. If you commit a crime of some sort,
yes,
then you should be held to account.
And I think these teens, you know, they're teens, they're out, you know, past curfew. And I think the parents should be involved, too. The parents need to be involved in even stopping what's going on downtown with these takeovers.
Look, it's like my kids at home. If they do something wrong and there aren't consequences to that, well, they're going to continue to do something that they shouldn't be doing.
Exactly.
So there's no difference here.
No.
Kids should be able to go downtown and enjoy the city. If they get into some stuff that they shouldn't be doing, well, then that's a different story. You're not just enjoying the city anymore.
That's right. There are consequences.
I think that's appropriate. Yeah. Meanwhile, a scary situation out of San Diego yesterday at a mosque shooting being investigated at this point as a hate crime. Two teenage shooters opened fire at a San Diego mosque. Three people killed. And then authorities say that they killed themselves a few blocks away.
Okay.
And then there was no specific threat made against the Islamic Center of San Diego. They found evidence that the suspects engaged in, quote, generalized hate rhetoric. Here is the San Diego police chief, Scott Wall, earlier in the day when he was initially summarizing the situation.
Our two suspects that are deceased. We have three victims at the Islamic Center. All three are adults.
And then you had the situation later on when he gave another update last night, and he talked about the person who actually called authorities.
A community member reported our two suspects in a vehicle, and it appeared they had gunshot wounds, and upon our arrival, we determined they were deceased.
So
they took themselves out?
One of the people that called law enforcement was shot.
Wow.
And later died. You know, how many people were saved, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a heroic last effort. Very strikingly similar to what we saw. Not similar in the way it was carried out, but at this mosque, there's a school.
But where it is,
there are kids.
Mm-hmm.
No kids were hurt.
Thank the Lord.
Thank God.
Yes.
But this, again, a pattern. We're seeing a pattern of hate. It's hate.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And it's a shame that you got to keep your head on a swivel when you're going into places of worship.
Lloyd, you know? I think you got to keep your head on a swivel anywhere anymore.
You do, but,
And that's the...
But we didn't used to it in places of worship.
No, but you didn't have to do it at a grocery store either.
True.
You didn't have to do it at a movie theater.
True.
You didn't have to do it at a mall.
Yeah, it's just...
And now you do.
You do, because it could happen anywhere.
It could, yes, it can happen anywhere, and now it certainly, yes, it does feel like places of worship are being targeted. Meanwhile, Donald Trump yesterday.
I put it off for a little while, hopefully maybe forever, but possibly for a little while, because we've had very big discussions with Iran, and we'll see what they amount to.
That's Donald Trump talking about a planned attack on Iran yesterday. He talked to a number of different people, stakeholders in the region, Qatar, the UAE, a number of others, that had asked him to put something off, that there was something in the works, and that they asked him to put it off because the discussions weren't going the way that he and negotiators here in the United States had wanted.
Right.
So i.e. Iran was hot-dogging this thing.
Yes, and it was time to put some heat on him.
Yes, and so at this point, the president said that there are serious conversations happening now. Again, we'll see. Iran engages in these serious conversations, and then until they don't.
Exactly. They play these games. They play games.
But he says that Iran is on the clock. The clock is ticking for them to make a deal. So, what that means, we'll see. But there was reporting that there was a Situation Room meeting that was going to be held today to potentially start more military action in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that still goes forward. I'm sure it will, but in terms of actual action today, he says he's holding off.
I'm wondering, who's putting the pressure on Iran if they're supposedly, seriously negotiating now after, the president held back on this. So who's putting the screws to Iran? Because it seems like Iran, they can take this pain. They've been taking a lot of pain. We've been taking some, too, but it seems like they're willing to hold out on it.
Well, who could be turning the screws? It could be China.
Could be China, yeah.
Certainly other Gulf nations are they've had enough of Iran at this point.
yes,
especially post Operation Epic Fury when they were bombing their sites or making them evacuate their vacation destinations and targeting banking institutions, things like that. Mm-hmm. So you start messing with other people's money and they're going to be upset too.
Yeah,
so they haven't created any new allies in the region either.
No. Two leading candidates for Michigan governor, they clashed sharply Monday night over campaign fundraising in a heated exchange that previewed the tone of the race ahead. The forum hosted by the UAW in Dearborn featured Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, former Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, and Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson. Duggan criticized Benson over contributions tied to a California tech executive, while Benson questioned Duggan's ties to a nonprofit that has spent millions supporting his campaign but does not disclose its donors. Both candidates accused the other of being influenced by corporate interests. Benson said voters should ask who candidates truly work for, while Duggan defending taking corporate-linked donations as part of building broader support across business and labor. Swanson, also seeking the Democratic nomination, largely stayed out of the direct clash but emphasized his support for working-class voters. UAW expected to announce an endorsement in the coming weeks.
Excuse me. Big money coming into that race, too. And we're going to talk to Craig Mauger coming up at 6:19 about that. Mark Furman has died. Did you see that news in the OJ trial?
I sure did. He died at the age of 74. Family associate says Furman died in Idaho last week from an aggressive form of throat cancer. Now, Furman became a national figure back in 1995 that during the trial of OJ Simpson, after helping investigate the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and discovering a key piece of evidence, a bloody glove outside her home. But his credibility later unraveled in court after recording surfaced in which he used racist language, which the defense used to challenge his testimony. He later pleaded no contest to perjury and retired from the LAPD. In later years, Furman worked as a media personality with Fox News, Fox Nation platform, and continued to maintain his innocence regarding allegations of racism.
Yeah, he never said, he always maintained the innocence of, I never planted any evidence.
Yes.
He said there was no way I could have planted evidence. I never planted evidence. But when you discredit the witness, as they did, then all bets are off at that point, obviously. Spoiler alert, OJ wasn't convicted.
Right, exactly.
I should put a warning on that.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, if you don't know how that panned out. Trajan Langdon is also expected to address the media today, the Pistons general manager. A disappointing end of the season. Really love our team, and we're going to do a better job of trying to build a winner here.
And we're going to get a shooter.
Yeah. We'd like somebody to score baskets.
Yes.
$600 million expected to be injected into this gubernatorial race here in Michigan. Is that really what we want? Greg Mauger on the other side. It's Jer Morning. So some fireworks last night.
Yeah.
At the UAW debate. And Mike Duggan, who, again, is bucking the trend, he's deciding to run for an independent. And what is interesting is Mike Duggan is now able to do things that a traditional candidate cannot do.
That's true.
Like, say, point to the fact of all the dark money that could be coming into the governor's race here in the state of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that you could see upwards of $600 million. He says it's predominantly corporate money. It's predominantly dark money,
yeah,
according to Mike Duggan.
He said he was tipped off by TV stations who told him that, you know, about this massive spending projection.
And so when you look, Craig Mauger, Melissa Ann Burke, Beth LeBlanc did a wonderful piece in the Detroit News. And this includes spending for the Michigan Senate race. It includes U.S. House races. It includes even money for the legislature here in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
As a comparison, they wrote, in 2018 across all 50 states, U.S. and House Senate races drew $5.7 billion across the country.
Wow.
And now you're talking about $600 million just in Michigan
just in
alone.
State. Just in Michigan.
Now, look, a couple of things. Michigan is a purple state.
It is.
And we've seen that over the last handful of years, yep. last decade or so.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there have been a number of states like Michigan where I'm sure there is a lot of money going in. But if you look at just the political roadmap for both Republicans and Democrats, quite frankly, Michigan is a really, really important state outside of the governor's race, which is huge in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely.
But just, you know, the U.S. Senate race here in Michigan is probably the biggest race in the country.
Huge.
On the Senate side.
Yes.
And it is going to be tight, a lot of money being spent. Mike Rogers just put out a new ad last week.
Mm-hmm.
So things are snowballing and money is coming in. And again, the governor's race is going to already draw a large amount of money.
Yeah, and when it comes to, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats in the governor's race, I mean, we have the primary that's coming up that will narrow it down to, you know, one Republican, one Democrat. But Mike Duggan doesn't have to worry about that. He's in. He's unopposed as an independent, so he's going to be there. So.
Well, then you have this, and this is my concern, and this is something that they've pointed out, and I've always kind of felt this way. Not kind of. I've definitely felt this way for a very long time.
Okay.
When you have outside money coming into races, oftentimes it's not fully disclosed, so you don't know where it's coming from.
Mm-hmm.
It makes transparency very difficult, and there's the worry that these outside interests then will have a vested interest inside. Right.
Yep.
It's somebody walking down your street and all of a sudden they're telling you what to paint your dining room.
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. You don't live in this house. What are you talking about?
Right.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
I don't want to paint it lime green. Yeah. Get out of here. So I think my concern has always been the influence, the lack of transparency. And then alleging any of our lawmakers or would-be lawmakers would be doing this, but just in general, well, then who pulls your strings? Who's got influence now over you?
That's right.
Somebody in Wyoming?
See, yeah.
Somebody in L.A.?
Mm-mm.
In New York?
Yeah, no.
That's the stuff that I don't like. And look, I again, not casting any aspersions. Partly, I think one of the reasons why that the state of Michigan is such a hot focus is because Governor Gretchen Whitmer is an absolute fundraising behemoth.
Oh.
She is a monster.
She can raise it. Yes,
a
she can.
A monster.
Yeah.
In fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And she has created a larger national profile.
Yeah.
And when you do that naturally, you're going to get outside interests. But this is big money that's flowing in. And Craig Mauger hops on the phone with us really quick. Craig, this is a really interesting piece that you guys wrote in the Detroit News. And this is a huge influx of money. Have we ever seen anything to this level at this point?
You know, that's a great question. I'd have to do a little bit more research on this. But the numbers that Mayor Duggan is talking about, I think would be a record for a midterm election. And a lot of what's driving it, you touched on some of it, how high-profile Machine is, but also this U.S. Senate race. He made a comment to me that he thought about half of this money, $600 million, half of that would be this U.S. Senate race, because this could be a tipping point race that decides control of the U.S. Senate in Washington, D.C. Republicans sense a real opportunity to win a Senate seat in Michigan for the first time in longer than three decades. And the Democratic primary is in a bit of disarray. I mean, it's a highly competitive primary. It's unclear who's going to emerge. So that's going to be a really costly piece of this. You've got congressional races for the U.S. House in Michigan that could help decide which party controls the U.S. House. So the national implications of what happens this fall here are extreme.
When voters, Craig, hear numbers like $600 million in dark money, does it actually change behavior, or has the public just become numb to it?
You know, that's a great question. I think the commercials, depending on what they say and what the tactics are, they do matter in these races because, I mean, that's one way people get to know who these candidates are. You know, I think one of the feelings I've gotten on the campaign trail so far this year is that voters are taking more of an interest of where this money is coming from. I covered a UAW forum for some of the gubernatorial candidates last night, and there were multiple questions about campaign finance. It didn't used to be that way. So there might be a new element emerging here of some interest in who is funding these candidates.
That's really interesting. Craig Mauger, unfortunately, we're out of time. We appreciate it. It's a great piece in the Detroit News. I would urge people to check it out. Craig Mauger, the state politics reporter, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, you got it. But I think that, again, I probably a huge, huge new threshold in midterm elections.
Yeah, but
this is something I imagine we're seeing in a lot of different areas.
And I'm wondering, you know,
every corner of the country.
If this race becomes as, you know, expensive as predicted, what does it mean for the lesser known candidates and independents trying to compete?
No doubt about it. Are you going to get deliveries from a drone? Could be happening very soon. It's next on JR Morning. Amazon Prime Air is expanding drone deliveries in Metro Detroit, but it's a relatively small operation still. These drones are only able to carry packages. I think it's under 5 pounds within a 7.5 mile radius of where the old Silverdome used to be. That's where the Amazon facility is.
Yeah.
And this is just a very, 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 very tiny fraction of the deliveries that Amazon makes in the area, particularly out of that facility every day. I think there's like over 3,500 employees there. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge, huge, huge facility. But this idea of expanding drone delivery operations, I think, is very, very cool. And it's all part of Mobility Makers Today. Lauren Wilson is the Prime Air Ops Manager in Pontiac and joins us to talk about it. Lauren, good morning. It's good to have you.
Hey, thanks. Good morning to you.
The future is certainly here. How many drones are you guys operating out of that facility at this point?
We have 14 drones on site.
And how many deliveries are they making a day, roughly?
We're making over 100, I will say. So we're averaging over 1,000 every week.
Wow. And what's the reaction been from the community so far? Are they excited, maybe curious, maybe a little skepticism?
So I think it's a little bit of all of that. I think mostly, though, I think that our neighbors and our community are very excited to have our service available to them. We fill up our queue every day. Even we see multiple customers that are buying packages and getting those deliveries even within the same day. So I think it demonstrates that our service is valuable to the customer. I think that we're able to meet a need that currently exists. And I think overall, I think the community is very happy to have us in the neighborhood.
I think it's very cool. Mm-hmm. What kind of packages can these drones carry? How long can they fly? Like, what are kind of those specifics about the drones themselves?
Absolutely. So we do have a standard size box that we use that is custom fit for the drone. So as you mentioned, the box can't weigh anything more than 5 pounds. So that includes the package, the stuffing that goes inside to protect the item and the item itself. The drone can travel up to a 7.5 mile radius. And then the average flight duration for a delivery, once we receive it from the fulfillment center and through our system, the average flight is going to be about 12 minutes there and back.
And, you know, Michigan weather, Lauren, is unpredictable, and that's putting it nice.
We saw that yesterday.
Exactly. How often are these drones grounded, and what happens when they are?
So we operate, the drone is actually called an MK-30, and it is designed to go beyond the limits of, like, perfectly clear weather. So it can operate in light rain and has a wide range of temperatures that it can operate in.
Mm-hmm.
So we really are looking to provide a reliable service for our customers so that when they make that drone order, we are anticipating weather. We look at weather all day long. We even anticipate it for the week. And so our intention is to provide that service for when customers order it. So within those capacities, we will order, or we will deliver the order, but we also really prioritize safety. So if it's not safe, we won't fly. So there absolutely are conditions such as icing that we will not fly in.
Mm-hmm.
And that will automatically ground the operation.
Mm. Is there a plan to expand beyond that 5.5 mile radius or add more to the fleet at this point?
So I definitely think that Amazon's the type of company where we're always looking to grow and prove, be better, and expand our reach. So I would say, yes, absolutely. There are plans to continue to allow additional people to opt into this service.
Is there any uncertainty about expanding into Detroit? I mean, what are some barriers there? Could it be, you know, density or regulations, infrastructure? Will it be expanding into Detroit?
Yeah, so there's lots of things that Amazon has to consider when they look at selecting locations. So part of that is going to be customer demand. It's going to be airspace considerations, whether or not it's a good community fit, and the ability to integrate with existing fulfillment networks. So all of our sites are currently located in conjunction with an existing fulfillment center.
Gotcha.
That could change in the future, but that's what we are currently.
It's very, very cool, and certainly can't wait for this thing to expand. I'd love to get a drone delivery
yeah,
at some
too.
Point. I think it's very, very cool, and we look forward to seeing the pictures and videos of people when they get these deliveries. Lauren Wilson, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time, and we'll talk again very soon.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, did you see this humanoid robot in Seoul?
Yes.
In South Korea? It was made an honorary Buddhist monk. It happened earlier this month. A 51-inch tall robot took part in a special ceremony at the main Buddhist temple. It wore traditional robes, received a Buddhist name, and now has become almost like a religious icon in the Buddhist temple there. It feels very strange when you start introducing these humanoid robot
yeah.
technologies into like religion as part of like these monks who have had, you know, they go through so much in their years of training and all of these things. And now this robot just walks in with a robe and he's like, hi.
I think it's also an attention grabbing spectacle too.
Yeah, sure.
That, you know, I mean,
sure.
You know, I don't know how much symbolism it is.
No.
You know, but.
No, but could you imagine going to church and a humanoid robot is standing there giving you, communion?
Communion, and I'm dipping in the.
I don't know.
Okay. I got to talk to you about that.
Well, tell the people what happened.
Okay. So during COVID, and my wife is Catholic, and I go to her church, and we kind of go to each other's churches. I'm Baptist. And so I went to her church during COVID. And so they give you the host, they give you the wafer.
This was at her church.
At her church.
The Catholic church.
Yes. And we're all in line, and I'm, you know, and I see people drinking out of the chalice,
uh-huh.
you know, and they wipe it down. And I'm like, we don't do that in my church. But I say, okay, so I don't know what I'm going to do. So when I get up there and it's my turn, I just dip my.
The other person's there holding the cup of wine.
Yes. And I just dip my.
And you just.
My host
Oreo cookied the host.
Yes, and I did it and did my cross and walked away. Now, I just went on Sunday.
And you did it properly.
No. Everybody was doing it that way. Everybody,
no, they weren't. You're
I'm
lying.
Telling, and I told Maria. I
Don't
said,
lie
I'm,
to the
I'm
people.
I'm telling Chris that everybody was doing it.
No
Yes, they were.
Way.
Yes.
We're
Sacred
dipping
Heart.
It.
Yep. Sacred Heart. Right in Detroit, right here. Everybody
oh
was dipping.
Oh, my gosh.
We're all dipping.
Jake made his first communion recently.
Okay.
And I thought I was going to say to him, like, don't dip it. Whenever you, and I didn't say it because then he was definitely going to dip it.
Okay.
So I didn't say it. But I did think about you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I told Marie I was going to tell you, so I'm glad this came up.
Yeah. coming up on the other side, the Michigan's population equation is upside down, and it's got economists worried. We'll talk about that. On the other side, it's JR Morning. So one of the things that we have been fighting here in the state for a very long time is our expected population decline. And the governor's office has tried to make a real effort to try to not only bring people into the state of Michigan, but retain the talent coming out of college, for example, trying to make sure that they have a good foundation here in the state of Michigan, which obviously means jobs.
Yeah.
It means good schools. Mm-hmm. It means being able to buy a home or live here. And all of those things factor in, but you've got currently an aging population here in the state of Michigan, and we don't have enough people staying or either or coming, and that is now shown in the kind of future forecasts of where the state is headed. And Beth LeBlanc wrote about this in the Detroit News, joins us this morning to talk about it. Beth, good morning. It's good to have you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, and this is something that lawmakers are talking about. It's something that is also being talked about amongst those running for governor, for example, here in the state.
Yeah. And, you know, the story that we did looking at population estimates looking forward, that was based on a presentation to given to lawmakers. Well, they're trying to predict what kind of future tax revenue they'll have, because that's what they use to kind of build the annual budget around. And so it's important to kind of understand who will be paying taxes in the future, whether it's income or sales or even property tax. And the news they got wasn't great. They were told that for the fifth year in a row, through like mid-2025, depending on what data you're looking at, Michigan has had what's called a natural decrease, which means deaths have outstripped births in the state of Michigan. And 2020 was the first time in Michigan's recorded history that occurred. But the demographer for the state said, you know, we were kind of on that path for a while. Like, it wasn't just the pandemic that put us over, although, of course, that did contribute. But now we've had five consecutive years, and they're making predictions into the future about what that will mean for the state.
Beth, how much of this is about aging baby boomers versus younger people simply not staying in the state?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a good question. Michigan, they said, does have kind of this big population of baby boomers. And, you know, that's causing issues in and of itself, because they're retiring out of the workforce. So you have a smaller labor force. They need, you know, in the coming years, more care. While the labor force is shrinking, they are contributing less like an income tax, right? Because they've retired and there are a lot of tax breaks for seniors. So it's all, all of the pieces are kind of moving right now and not moving in a great direction in terms of that. One of the stats they gave was that roughly a third of the state's population is over the age of 55 as of 2024. Mm. And so that's a good portion of the state that, you know, is either looking toward retirement or already retired.
Well, and one of the things that the report said, you wrote about it as well, is that COVID actually accelerated this trend of more deaths than births, meaning we're not keeping the population here in the state of Michigan. 2020 was the first time in modern state history that this happened, and this is expected to continue through 2030. And so the potential for slower economic growth is what's causing the real angst here, and just the tax revenue, the tax dollars that are going to be coming in is the thing that is worrying most lawmakers.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, in the context of where it was said, that was what they were concerned about, was the idea of like how this is going to affect the state budget. I think there are wider concerns whenever a society has this natural decrease, right, where deaths are exceeding births. But what they did say is that Michigan so far, throughout these 5 years where it's seen a natural decrease, its population actually has increased still, like marginally. Mm-hmm. And that is solely due to migration. So folks moving into Michigan, either from, either international migration or domestic migration, like from other states. So they said so far that's helped to kind of mask the issue here. But they don't anticipate that will be the case moving forward, and that eventually this natural decrease will start showing up in our overall numbers. And like you said at the beginning of this conversation, I mean, Michigan has long kind of sought a way to boost its numbers. We've hovered around 10 million, give or take, for decades now. And I think demographers are saying, well, yeah, we got to find ways to boost that number, but we got to find ways to make sure it doesn't sink even further at this point.
I'm wondering, too, if the population of school-age children, say, is projected to drop significantly, what does that mean for the state school system long-term?
Yeah, and I think they've already seen that. And, you know, sometimes I think in some respects it's a little difficult to tell because of school choice. So sometimes you see, you know, like certain schools kind of emptying out, but it might be because students are looking for a school, you know, elsewhere or commuting or whatever. But I think also this is an issue that overall the student population has gone down, and the schools have to start thinking about how to handle that, how to consolidate, how to better address the needs of the students who are there, even though there are fewer. It's definitely something everybody's looking at and trying to figure out. And I don't know that we've really felt like the crunch of it yet.
Mm-hmm.
At least from what they were saying in this, although in schools, I feel like you have started to see it, right? Like you do see a lot of, even in the Lansing area where I live, like a lot of schools closing down. So
yeah
it's one that has a lot of ripple effects that I think they're still trying to determine.
Beth LeBlanc at the Detroit News, thanks for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. Wonderful piece. And thank you. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you got it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm wondering, are we looking at a situation where, you know, the economy feels fine today, but it's slowly kind of weakening under the surface, you know?
Well, yeah, yes, I probably would agree. I think the it's almost like the chicken or the egg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, what needs to be addressed first?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Because if you're a family, if you're a young family, if you've got two kids under the age of 10 and you live in Colorado and you're coming to Michigan for a job, well, what are you most interested in? The education system.
Absolutely.
Where are good schools?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if good schools are here and the average cost of a house is $700,000, well, that puts you in a really tough spot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or what happens when, you know, you need car insurance or all of these things.
They factor in.
It's the education system. Then it's the cost of living. Then it's
what
type of amenities do we have in the area? Mm-hmm. All of these things play in. So what do you address first? Do you address the jobs, the need for jobs to then fill those jobs? Or do you try to impact the education system in the upward trajectory to get up above Mississippi?
Man, you got to bring people in to have people stay,
young
people be here.
It is very tough. It is very tough. And we need babies born here in the state of Michigan. We need to keep them coming, all the babies. 7 o'clock hour coming up. Get you caught up on the latest headlines. Also, AI-equipped vehicles could be helping those in rural Michigan. It's next. 7 o'clock hour. Good to have you. Donald Trump postponing an attack on Iran.
Again.
Resuming some sort of military action. And the part of the reason is because he says that, really kind of twofold. He said, I was asked by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, and some others if we could put it off for 2 or 3 days, a short period of time, because they think they are getting very close to making a deal. And if we can do that, where there's no nuclear weapon going into the hands of Iran, he said he's going to do it.
I've put it off for a little while, hopefully maybe forever, but possibly for a little while, because we've had very big discussions with Iran, and we'll see what they amount to.
So put your little hand in my... I mean, tell me if you've heard this before.
I've heard it before.
Right? It's like Groundhog's Day.
And I don't think the president wants to go military if he doesn't have to.
No.
But you can't keep saying, I'm going to destroy you, and then, well, we're going to postpone it because we're getting closer. And every time we hear that, then Iran just kind of BS's and we don't get closer. Mm-hmm. And then we start this. I just hope this isn't one of those again.
Well, the president is expected to hold a situation room meeting today on the revival of some sort of military action. So It's possible that this is a, as he says, maybe just a couple of day pause to see if the Iranians are ready to come to the table and make a real deal. If they're not, then I guess we'll see what 3 days holds. But we are still technically in this ceasefire.
Yeah.
The Iranian regime has fired drones and missiles towards the UAE, towards others in the Gulf.
The strait's still closed.
The strait is still closed. The blockade is still in play. So all of those things, nothing really has fundamentally changed. But the negotiations that are continuing have kind of stalled out as well.
Yeah.
So we're just kind of in this holding pattern. Donald Trump seemed to indicate that there would be something coming today, but that's on hold for now.
A 14-year-old recovering after being shot during a large downtown gathering of teenagers in Detroit over the weekend. It's an incident that also led police to take two other teenagers into custody. Authorities say a weapon was recovered following that late-night violence near Farmer Street in Grand River. The shooting comes as the city continues to confront these so-called teen takeovers, social media-driven gatherings that have at times led to curfews, arrest, and increased police presence. Detroit police say curfew enforcement remains in effect, 10 p.m. for those 15 and under, 11 p.m. for older teens. Mayor Mary Sheffield says her six-point community safety plan is still in place, combining enforcement with prevention efforts like neighborhood investment, mental health services, and late-night recreation programs. But she says there will be zero tolerance for any violence.
I think there's a large portion of young people who want to come down and just enjoy themselves, but you do have a group of individuals who come down and cause chaos and disruption, and those individuals will be held accountable. We have zero tolerance for disruptive and criminal behavior. They will be held accountable.
Mayor Sheffield says the city also is pushing for greater parental accountabilities as officials brace for this busier summer season.
Kristen Hennings, a professor and director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic at Georgetown Law, and according to a piece in NPR, she defines teen takeovers as a group of teenagers who get together at a designated time and location to do what teenagers do, socialize, hang out with friends, and spend time outdoors.
Okay. That's not what was happening downtown.
A kid got shot, correct?
Yes, someone was shot downtown.
We're watching videos of a situation in D.C.
Yeah.
Where they're what, in a restaurant, beating people over head with a high chair?
Just fighting.
I mean,
I don't even know they knew who they were fighting. They just fight.
I remind people that what you see on the news in some reporting, you're only getting a small piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There are kids that just want to go downtown
and
walk around.
Hang out.
And have a nice time.
And have a good time.
Unfortunately for them, you've got these knuckleheads that are causing chaos.
And you got to deal with them.
And unfortunately, it casts a pall over everybody.
It does. And there has to be consequences.
And so for the people that the mayor's administration is trying to reach out to, of course, they're going to be receptive because they just want to hang.
That's it. That's all.
But that's all they want to do.
But the ones who want to start issues, they're not trying to hear what the mayor is saying. They want to go down and cut up. And that's where you have to have the police come in.
A really sad situation out in San Diego. A mosque was targeted. Three adults killed, including a security guard there. Again, not entirely similar, but very similar in a lot of aspects to what we saw at Temple Israel.
Yeah.
Where security guards got involved and thwarted that assailant there, would-be assailant. A security guard killed at this mosque in San Diego. There were kids there, school there. Those kids were safe,
yes,
thankfully.
Thank God.
But again, the horror, the terror that goes into this, authorities are describing this as a hate crime. Here's the San Diego Police Chief, Scott Wall.
Our initial officers that got on scene did not engage with the suspects in the parking lot. They began to make entry into the Islamic Center. They observed three deceased bodies outside of the center.
Those two teen gunmen were also found dead, self-inflicted gunshot wounds. And again, I haven't seen any information on them yet.
No, I haven't.
No identities
gunmen. Or anything.
Yeah,
no.
But we're keeping a watch on that. But they are investigating it as a hate crime, something that we'll continue to follow.
And a civil rights lawsuit has been filed against Wayne County and the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services following a sexual assault of a teenager at a juvenile detention facility. The suit stems from a 2024 incident at the William Dickerson Juvenile Detention Facility where 16-year-old Rashard Calhoun was assaulted by a staff member. That employee has since been convicted and is now incarcerated. Attorneys for the family allege broader failures by staff and supervisors, saying surveillance video showed the abuse lasting more than 40 minutes without intervention. They argue it reflects a systemic breakdown in oversight and protection of detained youth. Calhoun's father says the family was left in the dark during the ordeal and has been deeply traumatized. The county and state say they cannot comment on pending litigation and note that they have not yet been formally served with the lawsuit.
Jeez, just a bunch of great headlines.
Wow.
Here to talk about. We are going to talk about something a little more positive. AI could be helping those in the state of Michigan that are in rural areas when it comes to medical assistance, something that we're going to talk about on the other side. But first at 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. This morning on the Business Beat, we're taking a look at a hot retail category to see who's winning and who's fading. The category, athletic apparel, a near universal category in which Nike leads by a wide margin. They own a 22% mental market share, the broadest occasion footprint in a new study conducted by Morning Consult. Now, for reference, mental market share means a brand's mental availability, how often it comes to mind compared to competitors when consumers think of buying in a given category. Following Nike, which has more than double market share over the next competitor, that competitor, Adidas, at 11% and Under Armour at 10%. Nike is recalled across more purchase occasions than any other brand, including triggers like replacing worn-out gear, stylistic triggers like athleisure, and utilitarian triggers like everyday wear. Awareness is highest among 65-plus adults, 93%, and remains strong among 18 to 34-year-olds as well at 76%. Now, there are new challengers emerging in this category. Aloe Yoga leads the yoga Pilates category at 39%, ahead of Lululemon at 32%. When it comes to gym training wear, the leader is Gymshark at 36%, ahead of Under Armour at 35%. And brands not doing as well as expected, Reebok is at 6.5% mental market share, while Champion sits at 5.2%. Well-known brands, but those brands get left behind when consumers are about to make purchase decisions. All in all, the athletic apparel category showing strong retail results for brands and retailers alike. No doubt one which aspiring entrepreneurs should take a close look at if you're thinking of starting or growing a business of your own. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
You know, in Michigan, when it comes to medical care, medical accessibility, especially for people in northern Michigan, rural areas of Michigan, underserved areas of our state, there we've seen workforce shortages.
Oh, hospitals, you know, closing.
Nurses and doctors, not enough people on staff to carry out the care. Hospital closures, like you mentioned. Yes, certainly that plays a role. And as a result, researchers at the University of Michigan are developing mobile medical units. They're essentially like a hospital on wheels.
Mm-hmm.
They can drive to a parking lot. They can pull up into a Walmart. And if you're in these areas where you're kind of in that medical desert, right, where you don't have access immediately, then you can come. A nurse will be there. A PA will be there, a mm-hmm. physician's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And there is going to be – you're going to be able to do different types of scans, and it's going to walk through the process with the nurse or with a medical professional, even though a specialist might not be there. So you're going to be able to get care at one of these mobile medical units. This is all thanks to AI technology that's being utilized in these vehicles.
Wow.
It's very, very cool. And Jason Corso is the Toyota Professor of Artificial Intelligence at the University of Michigan and joins us this morning to talk about it. Jason, it's great to have you. Where did this idea spawn from for you guys at U of M?
Great to be here, guys. This idea came from an earlier project that was funded by DARPA, all around perceptually enabled task guidance. Like, basically, you know, if I'm a human, I'm doing something in the world, cooking, repairing an engine, you know, like, how can AI watch what I'm doing and guide me through the process? And then we began talking to some clinical friends and ARPA-H, and recognize that, wait a second, this is really useful for medical care as well. In fact, the initial idea was something like, you know, you're a driver on the road somewhere in central Michigan, northern Michigan, nearest hospital is like 40 miles away, and you come across a bad accident, and you're just an average guy or average gal, like, what do you do, right? Like, how could you possibly work through that situation to help save whoever might be hurt at that accident? You know, through conversations, we work through the idea to acknowledge that, wait, maybe this is broader than just emergencies. And then if you look at the data, like you guys were just saying, indeed, like the average distance someone has to travel to get to the nearest hospital increased something like eightfold in the last 20 years. It's ridiculous, mm-hmm. actually. So the whole idea was, how can we leverage this new physically grounded AI? That means kind of like ChatGPT that can watch you and then recognize what you should be doing versus what you shouldn't be doing to guide you to achieve a better outcome. How can we put that into a mobile clinic and then go drive around, like you said, to a parking lot, to someone's backyard? Frankly, we have some colleagues in Pennsylvania doing this as well. They drive out to the cornfield. We have some photos of that. It's really awesome. And just really bring the care that you would get to the person rather than making the person come for the care.
So, Jason, yeah. You're essentially trying to bring hospital-level care into places where specialists may be hundreds of miles away. Does this finally close the gap, you know, a gap that we've been talking about for, I mean, decades, or is it still just a partial solution?
Well, I think we're hoping that it would close the gap, right? You know, we are at the university, so we are researchers at heart, right? So it might be, one could argue, wait a second, you guys aren't going to have any real impact. But I believe actually that we're farther along than we think. You know, we're about 18 months into our project already. We support clinical services like cardiac health, looking for blood clots in the lower body, all through ultrasound. So it is a scan that you do. We're now in the vehicle that we're envisioning that would be an X-ray machine, for example. So now we have the AI that can guide the RN or PA, as you said, to position the patient properly. And even working through how do you train someone, right? Mm-hmm. So care is one thing, but training people is another thing. So now we're thinking about adding mechanisms like training for intubation and so on as well into the vehicle so that we can go and really have an impact. So, I mean, I think it's going to be, you know, it takes a whole village to solve this problem, right? We have to think a little bit differently around medical care. But I think this is certainly one step in the right direction.
You guys are on a five-year, almost $25 million federally funded project. You mentioned that other states are doing something similar. You mentioned Pennsylvania. How closely are you watching what they do, or kind of piggybacking off of the successes or quite frankly, failures that they've had to improve what we're doing here?
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. So we actually on this project are part of a larger program called Paradigm that it has different task areas, right? So our task area is indeed this AI agent that's in the vehicle to help. Other task areas, for example, are building the vehicle, doing the software integration, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, there is a large amount of collaboration, specifically, you know, with our friends in Pennsylvania at Penn State. We've begun to have conversations around building a coalition of researchers like ourselves who are forward-looking and recognizing that, wait, maybe these physically grounded AI agents in the healthcare vehicle are a way to solve the healthcare shortage. And we are definitely sharing notes. You know, most of the work that we're doing is being published openly. The software is going to be open sourced, right? So we're all about sharing and actually solving the problem.
Jason, if this works exactly as intended, what's the biggest thing you think is going to change? Will it be access? Will it be outcomes, or even the structure of healthcare itself?
Well, I think the biggest thing could indeed be the structure of healthcare itself, right? Like the program manager for this overall Paradigm program, Bon Q, I was talking to him last night. In fact, he's in town this week, and he was arguing that. So on the order of 80% of all medical care does not need to happen at the, you know, inside of a building in a brick and mortar facility. A lot of that can happen either remotely or in one of these vehicles. And if we really think about what that means for the overall process of accessibility in healthcare, in the overall system, I think we would see that pretty heavily impacted.
It's very cool what you guys are doing.
It is.
And I think that when it comes to the use of artificial intelligence technology. This is a wonderful, positive use, and I absolutely love it. Jason Corso, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it, and we'll talk again soon. Keep us updated on this project.
Right on. Thanks, guys. Have a good day.
Yeah, you as got well. It. You do the same. Very cool. Meanwhile, a story out of the Wall Street Journal, the number of people who died from drug overdoses dropped again in 2025.
That's a good thing.
It is a great thing, especially as we come out of the fentanyl crisis, the opioid crisis.
But I think the fentanyl crisis kind of helps, I think, because people understand that these drugs that they're getting, these street drugs, could have fentanyl in it, and it could take you out. And I just think more people are afraid, and they're just saying, listen, I gotta stop this. I can't do this because I'm rolling the dice here. You don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. And it can be incredibly deadly. I mean, the very smallest amount.
One and done. It can be one and done.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one of the first times I spoke with, I believe it was Sheriff Mike Bouchard about it.
Okay.
He said, well, you know, officers put gloves on when they make a bust or when they're handling the substance or whatever.
Sure.
And I'm like, gloves? And they're like, yeah, it's that deadly.
Mask, too.
Yes. I mean, like, full protection.
Yeah.
Because it's that deadly. So the fact that there were, and look, 69,973 drug overdoses last year. That's 69,973 more than we'd like.
That's exactly.
You know, but again, it's going down. And that's positive news.
I love it.
Yeah, certainly. Coming up on the other side, teens are drinking less, and they're becoming a more sober generation, Gen Z. It's next on J.R. Morey. For a couple of years, there's been these trends that younger people, Gen Zers for the most part, are drinking significantly less, drinking alcohol less. Mm-hmm. They're a less social group of young Americans than there ever has been before. And this kind of started around the COVID time. But again, it's been trending for some time. And there's it kind of seems to signal a broader shift, a cultural shift. And this was something that was reported on in Axios. I find it very fascinating because, I mean, I think if you still go to college towns, you still see a fair amount of imbibing. Partying.
Things
are happening.
You do.
But Gen Zers are drinking less than they have in the past at that age. Very fascinating. Rachel Ginfaza is the founder of Up and Up, which is a research firm focused on Gen Z in particular, and joins us this morning. Rachel, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
So what is the driving force here for Gen Z to be drinking less, to be a more sober group of Americans?
Yeah, so, you know, as you were mentioning, it goes beyond that they're drinking less. They're also having less sex. They're getting their licenses later. They're living with their parents. They're pushing off marriage. And so I think when you look at the forces that are playing into this for young adults, it really was a mix of the COVID-19 pandemic and also social media as a perfect storm of factors that have really changed how young people socialize and the ways in which we hang out.
I don't know, you've described Gen Z as a generation of late bloomers. Is this delay more about choice? Is it about pressure or just a changing definition of independence?
I think it's all three. I think if you look at the sort of pressure points that are put upon young people today, there's a lot of economic anxiety. And so for some people, they might not be able to afford alcohol or afford going on dates. There was a Bank of America study last summer that showed that the average young person is spending $0 a month on dates, and that's a time when people might traditionally drink. Then there's also just sort of this delayed adulthood, which I think in part is a shift in habits and expectations, in part because of COVID and social media. And then on top of that, there's also this movement promoting wellness and, as I wrote about a couple of weeks ago, this idea of looks maxing, which is really just optimizing to be the best version of yourself. There's a whole conversation about this new skinny culture that we're in the age of GLP-1s. And, you know, while I'm not I'm not sure that, you know, all of these young people, the reason why is because of that, but I do think it's playing into it. And I had a young man who was 25 tell me that part of the reason why he's never been interested in drinking is because of that wellness trend. And he feels that he has a lot of friends who are cutting it out because it makes them feel yucky or gain weight, and also that it costs a lot of money. So I do think it's those three factors, sort of the economic piece of this, the broader conversation about health and wellness going on in the country, and the information young adults are getting on their social media algorithms that are talking about health and wellness. And then on top of that, there's been these changes in, there's a loneliness crisis and the way that we hang out. So I think it's again, a perfect storm of factors.
I don't want to sound like, you know, old guy back in my day, but as soon as I could take driver's ed, I was in that classroom.
Same with
as
me.
Soon as I was able to get some sort of freedom, I was looking for it. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case anymore. But I also didn't have access to Uber or Lyft or have the ability to get around without needing to go through the rigmarole of learning how to drive.
That's true.
But it does seem there are significant shifts in just kind of the more simple standard things that you do as you grow up that they're just not participating in.
Totally. And I think social media has really reduced the friction in young people's lives. And you don't necessarily need to put yourself out there in the way that prior generations had. And simultaneously, I think both COVID and social media has lowered Gen Z's tolerance for risk. And I think it's not necessarily, I wrote about this in my piece about late bloomers, but it's not necessarily young adults' fault that these shifts are occurring. But I think it's worth considering the way in which everyone's confidence and tolerance for risk taking has changed in this environment that they've grown up in. And when they look around and they look at their friends, you know, everyone's in the same boat. So it's not like they're sort of delayed compared to their peers. But when you do look at prior to other generations or compared to other prior generations, that's, I think, when you see some of the change and the delay in when these milestones are being reached. So it's worth noting that they might not necessarily be feeling this pressure amongst themselves either, where in the past, friends might have compared themselves to their peers, and that might have driven some of these social milestones as well.
Rachel, one researcher said that alcohol has always kind of been deeply social. The use of alcohol has been deeply social. Now, if teens are not drinking, what are they using to replace that social glue moment?
That's a great question. I think many teens are socializing online and are finding ways to keep themselves busy really by scrolling, which is pretty depressing when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's the reality of the way that many young adults are spending their time today.
Interesting. Rachel Zinfaza, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. And we'll talk again very soon, I hope.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you got it.
Very interesting, man.
It is interesting. I mean, again, look, things change.
They do.
Things change. And it was...
And social media is part of that as well.
Absolutely.
Too,
when you first read the story, I'm like, what? Huh?
That used to... Back in the day?
Now, all right. Let me say this as the disclaimer.
Okay.
I was perfect. I never did anything that I shouldn't have done.
Uh-huh.
Now, for you, yeah. I got down. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Of course. I was, you know, whatever. It's what you do. Mom, I never did anything wrong.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Until you cut the corner. Went around that corner. You don't know what happened.
I'm just saying. I'm just saying. Now that we got all that cleared up.
Yeah.
Interesting story out of Cranes. The traditional business lunch has changed dramatically since the pandemic, and it really hasn't come back the same way. Many full-size restaurants, full-service restaurants, rather, that had always counted on the steady lunch service, is they're not seeing the customer traffic that they once
People
did.
People are working from home. They're allowed to work from home, so they're just going in the refrigerator.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Lunch.
And still, that's the case. Now, this feels like kind of an old story at this point, but it's fascinating that it continues to linger because hybrid work is kind of the dominant force now.
Yeah.
It's not work from home necessarily. There's some combination of
it's
and out.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I think even when you're in, it's not the same.
No. No, and
even
and,
when you're in the office, you're not really doing the same things that you did 6 years ago.
No, and the restaurants are starting to feel it, and you know prices are high, and people are trying to save. A lot of people, even sometimes when they're in, they bring their lunch,
right? Right,
so they have to go out, you know, because it's cheaper.
I just
them.
Never like
right
when I, you know, again, long time ago, different positions sure. and all that stuff,
sure.
but like. I'd go across the street and get something for lunch, or we
when I
would go
downtown.
Some, absolutely.
I was always somewhere
going
downtown.
Somewhere.
Sure.
Now I don't even think about it.
No. No.
And I mean, the food around here is fantastic.
It's great.
Not that about
it's
that.
Not, no.
It's just the habit has certainly changed.
Changed.
Yeah, very interesting. Coming up on the other side, we know how to fix the roads. Governor, listen, we're talking about it next on JR Morning. All right, so I should make a correction. We don't know how to fix the roads. I don't know anything about how to fix a road. But thankfully,
you have an idea, though.
Thankfully.
Somebody has an idea.
There are people that do
yes.
know how to fix the roads. And increasingly, we are seeing recycled scrap tires used in road construction as a way to improve our infrastructure while addressing the problem of discarding these tires mm-hmm. and doing away with them. And there's been an effort to blend up the ground old rubber from the old tires into asphalt, creating material that's flexible, it's durable, it holds up potentially in Michigan's freeze, thaw, hot, cold. Wednesday when I hit three kids at baseball, it was 30 degrees, then 80 degrees 2 days later. You know, that kind of weather.
Just tell all your business. Just
what I did. Poor kid, I hit him right in the hand. I felt terrible. It was freezing. But that's the good news, is
yeah.
there are innovative ways that we're seeing this take place. James Lillo is the engineer manager in the Bay County Road Commission and joins us this morning. James, it's good to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. So let's talk about it, because millions of tires are discarded every year. What's the benefit of using them in our roadways? First they were on them, now they're in them.
Yeah, you guys basically just hit the nail on the head. We're finding that it's flexible, the freeze-thaw. It stops cracking, slows it, so that you put rubber in the asphalt, rubber in chip seal. It flexes with the 30 to 80 degree swings, and definitely is keeping the water out from under the road, which is where you want to keep it. So keep it on the road, not under the road. So it definitely is something that we are having a lot of luck with here.
Do you see this as a uniquely good fit for Michigan, or could it become a national standard, maybe in other colder states?
Absolutely. Michigan's kind of, I will say, a little behind. Minnesota, Wisconsin, a lot of the northern states already are using it. It is, I'll say, newish in Michigan. There's counties that have been using it for a while. We've used it since 2016, I think, was our first project. But there's a lot of other counties here, but there's a lot of effort in actually part of a group out of Minnesota that are trying to get it standardized also across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about the process that you have to process these tires so you can get them ready to be used as a material for road repairs or road construction?
Yeah, bunch of years ago, I've been in the business 35 years, and I don't know, 15, 20 years ago that they tried this and they ground up tires, and it was like throwing a bunch of radials in there. You know, they chopped them up and bigger pieces. Right now, they grind it right down to dust. Nestle Quick's a good example. It's that fine.
Wow.
They get all the foreign material, so to speak, out of the tire. They get just the rubber. The rubber is then you know, they process it down, and it's taken to either an asphalt plant where it is added to the mixture while the asphalt is, you know, being made. Or in the case of chip seal, it's added to an emulsion, which is, for everybody, it's tar, liquid tar, and mixed, heated, and then able to be put down as the tar or emulsion layer for chip seal. So it's actually pretty easy. Obviously, the processing to get the tires down to that fine consistency is tougher, but the actual placement of it in the asphalt and then chip seal emulsion is pretty easy.
James, you know, beyond the better roads, I'm figuring that there's also an issue of what happens to these millions and millions of scrap tires. Does this kind of feel like a partial solution to a bigger environmental backlog?
Definitely. Yeah, that was one of the things that it's what underutilized waste stream is the buzzword that you're taking something exactly that people throw away. They throw in the back, you know, the backyard, the woods, you see them, and or there's just piles of them. And it's something that definitely being a road builder, I'm a road builder, but it does feel good to be able to use something like that to, you know, clean up the environment and make things, you know, a little bit better and use something, use something used to, you know, make something new.
So yeah, new to you, right?
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What is the cost structure for this? Is it more expensive up front, but then on the back end you're making less road repairs if it's done right? Or is it financially responsible up front too?
It is more expensive. It's all, I mean, relatively, you know, in Bay County and versus Detroit or Grand Rapids or anything, obviously cost of living and all that, the numbers change a little bit. But for us, you know, $5 a ton for asphalt, chip seal, we usually, if we chip seal a road, it's usually two passes. This stuff, it's one. So it's actually dang near even.
Wow.
Because, you know, you're only going over it one time, plus you're getting the benefit of the flexibility, the durability, and you know, so up front for chip seal, it's pretty, you know, it's almost a wash. And for in fact, I'll say it is a wash. The asphalt, you know, $5 a ton. You do, you know, a million tons, that's 5 million. But if, you know, most of our projects are in 5,000, 2,000, 3,000 ton, you're talking, you know, $5,000.
Yeah,
that's nothing.
Right. Well, you know, it's fascinating, and it sounds like just like the tires, it's new to us here in Michigan. Other states have done it. We need to get on board. James Lillo, appreciate the time this morning. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for the invite. And, yeah, have a great week.
Yeah, you do the same. You do the same.
It's basketball courts in the city that are made from recycled tires.
It's awesome.
At some of these parks. And it's for the same reason. You know, it freezes, you know, the weather freezes. But you don't have to go and do repairs all the time.
Doesn't it say Goodyear over by, like, the free throw line?
No, it doesn't have Goodyear on it. But, I mean, it's great. The ball bounces great.
Right.
You can, you know, good grip on your gym shoes.
That's pretty cool.
It's cool.
A federal judge ruled against Elon Musk in that lawsuit against OpenAI and Sam Altman, threw out the case entirely after finding Elon Musk waited too long to file it.
He's not done yet, is he? He's going to keep trying to do something.
The jury said that the claims were outside the time limit, the statute of limitations, and the judge accepted that finding, meaning that OpenAI, Altman are not liable for any of these allegations.
Okay.
Yeah, but that was certainly a high-profile case.
It was.
Yeah, certainly.
For sure.
Coming up on the other side, 8 o'clock hour, we'll get you caught up on the headlines, of course. Also, a UN climate committee moving away from the doom and gloom of climate change. What does that mean? We'll discuss all coming up in the 8 o'clock hour. It's Jared Morning.
Other areas really got high winds, those straight line winds or something.
Yeah. I'm coaching Jake's base coach pitch team.
Uh-huh.
And I'm also coaching Henry's t-ball team. I have 6 nights of baseball.
Oh, my goodness.
We got it canceled last night.
You had a day off yesterday?
I was like,
well, listen.
Good on that.
They're saying we might have a carbon copy this afternoon after 4 o'clock. We may have a carbon copy of what happened yesterday.
Shucks.
All right. You don't seem too upset about it.
I'm very broken up about it. How dare you?
Okay, my bad.
We've been talking a lot about these teen takeovers.
Yeah.
And they've popped up in Washington, D.C. Those were some of the big stories coming out this morning. Video on that. Uh-huh. And just like a brawl in like a restaurant.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
what reason, we don't know, but it's ridiculous. We've seen them in Chicago, in on the East Coast, things like that. And, of course, here in the city of Detroit. And there's been efforts to try to push back on that, particularly the ones that are causing trouble.
Yeah, and it got to a point where you had these teen takeovers downtown and, you know, fighting and things. But, you know, people were saying they don't want this to escalate. And it did kind of escalate over the weekend, where a 14-year-old is now recovering after being shot during one of these teen takeovers. It's an incident that also led police to take two other teenagers into custody, and authorities say a weapon was also recovered following the late night violence. Now, it took place around Farmer Street and Grand River downtown over the weekend, and the shooting comes as the city continues to confront these teen takeovers, social media-driven gatherings that have at times led to curfews, arrests, and increased police presence. Detroit police say curfew enforcement remains in effect, 10 p.m. for those 15 and under, 11 p.m. for older teens. And Mayor Mary Sheffield says her 6-point community safety plan is still in place, combining enforcement with prevention efforts like neighborhood investment, mental health services, and late night recreation programs. But she says there will be zero tolerance for violence.
So we are going to continue to push enforcement and accountability. I want to be very clear that while this administration is creating safe spaces and investing in prevention, we equally are promoting accountability and enforcement, and we will not tolerate violence. We will not tolerate what we saw this weekend, and we will continue to push for parental responsibility enforcement in our curfew. And so it's not an either or, it's a both and we believe that our approach will continue to yield the results we want to see.
Yeah, both and. That's very important, because you're going to have teenagers who come downtown who just want to enjoy downtown
yeah.
and hang out. But then you have those who want to start trouble, and you got to deal with them a little differently, and it needs to be consequences.
Needs to be consequences. Should there be consequences for the family, for
Absolutely.
Parents too,
for parents
caretakers,
as well.
Whoever?
Absolutely, because these are teenagers who shouldn't be out at a certain time anyway, and you know there's a curfew. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and then you've got the situation out in San Diego that we've been following as well, a shooting at a mosque in San Diego in the Claremont neighborhood. Two teen suspects died of self-inflicted gunshot wounds, according to Police Chief Scott Wall, and three people were killed, including a security guard. I believe they were all adults. There were mm-hmm. children there. There was a school there. All those children were safe. There was a reunification center. It felt very, I mean, it brought back what happened at Temple Israel.
It did. Wow.
You know, in different set of circumstances mm-hmm. around the attackers, but the same type of
parishioners, kids,
scare.
Everything,
yeah.
You know, same
yeah.
thing. Yeah.
And here's the police chief, Scott Wall. He talked about what the scene looked like when his police got there.
Our initial officers that got on scene did not engage with the suspects in the parking lot. They began to make entry into the Islamic Center. They observed three deceased bodies outside of the center.
And he also talked about the person who actually called 911.
A community member reported our two suspects in a vehicle, and it appeared they had gunshot wounds. And upon our arrival, we determined they were deceased.
Wow.
Just it's incredibly
horrible.
Sad.
It is.
And again, you're at a place of worship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another yeah. place of worship targeted, and police are investigating this as a hate crime.
Got a postponement of some military action?
Yeah, Donald Trump says, well, you know, I've been talking to the UAE and Qatar and some other countries and Saudi Arabia, and they feel like Iran is ready to make a deal. And so,
I mean, but they were ready to make a deal how many other times?
Well, a lot of times.
Okay.
A lot of times. It feels like the same old song and dance over again. Here's the president.
I've put it off for a little while. Hopefully, maybe forever, but possibly for a little while. Because we've had very big discussions with Iran, and we'll see what they amount to.
And there's expected to be a situation we're meeting about potential military action, a plan put in place if this round of talks doesn't work,
yeah.
doesn't come to any fruition here. In achieving some sort of diplomatic peace.
A couple of candidates for Michigan governor, they clashed sharply last night over campaign fundraising. It's a heated exchange that previewed the tone of the race ahead. The forum, hosted by the United Auto Workers in Dearborn, featured Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, former Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, and Genesee County Sheriff Chris Swanson. Duggan criticized Benson over contributions tied to a California tech executive, while Benson questioned Duggan's ties to a nonprofit that has spent millions supporting his campaign but does not disclose its donors. Both candidates accused the other of being influenced by corporate interests. Benson said voters should ask who candidates truly work for, while Duggan defended taking corporate-linked donations as part of building broader support across business and labor. Swanson, also seeking the Democratic nomination, largely stayed out of it. He stayed out of that direct clash, but he emphasized his support for working-class voters. The UAW expected to announce an endorsement in the coming weeks.
Interesting.
That'll be pretty big when it happens.
It will be very big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it'll be very big. Also, Mark Furman died, came to prominence really during the O.J. Simpson case.
Yeah, he died at the age of 74. A family associate says Furman died in Idaho last week from an aggressive form of throat cancer. Furman became that national figure during the O.J. trial after helping investigate the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and discovering a key piece of evidence, that bloody glove outside her home. But his credibility later unraveled in court after recording surfaced in which he used racial language, which the defense used to challenge his testimony. He later pleaded no contest to perjury and retired from the LAPD. In later years, he worked as a media personality with Fox News' Fox Nation platform and continued to maintain his innocence regarding allegations of racism.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah, he was asked, had he ever used the N-word? He said, no, never used it. And then they pulled out a tape of him using it.
Yeah, and that's good legal work, right?
Yeah.
You discredit the witness.
And, you know, reasonable doubt, right? I mean,
well,
you know.
And again, he maintained his innocence in planting that glove. He said, I never planted the glove. There was no way I could have done that.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I think O.J. was at that time, O.J. was an actor.
Oh, are you kidding?
He's trying to put that glove on.
You got to see, I'm going to tell you, you got to see Tommy Davidson do that.
I can't get it on.
Tommy, the comedian, you got to see him do that. And you have to see, let me tell you who else, Jamie Foxx does a great O.J. impersonation.
Does he really?
Oh, yeah. The whole walk and everything. You know, O.J. had bad knees.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, a federal jury ruled against Elon Musk in that lawsuit against Sam Altman and OpenAI, throwing the case out entirely. They did not rule, which is what Elon Musk brought forward in the first place, which was OpenAI abandoned its original mission as a nonprofit, trying to help humanity. Instead, all they did was focus on profits and enriching those on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't claim, they didn't rule on that. They ruled that he waited too long to file it, he being Elon Musk. So the statute of limitations had eclipsed.
It ran out, yeah.
And so that they weren't even going to focus on whether or not OpenAI abandoned its original mission as a nonprofit to go to a for-profit system.
So, I mean, it's too late now. It's a done deal. You can't even go back in and try again because
it's late
too late.
At the moment, yeah. Trajan Langdon also expected to speak today, the GM of the Pistons.
Okay.
Good season.
Yep.
Ended too early. Really liked the development of our players. And I'd also like him to say, and we're going to find some more offense.
Yeah. That's kind of in a nutshell.
That's what I'd like to hear from Trajan Langdon. And I expect to hear something like that
similar
from Trajan Langdon.
Yeah.
I think he knows exactly what the problems were, especially
yes.
in the postseason.
Yes.
So you go get another score.
Yep.
That's it. That's all you got to do.
Okay.
Just do that.
You got a preview right now from Chris.
That's
what's going to happen.
That's the fan perspective.
Okay, I think that's a lot of fans' perspective.
The nuts and bolts are a little more difficult than that. Coming up on the other side, is the climate change issue overblown? We'll discuss next on JR Morning. It's WJR's Tim McGraw VIP experience. Your chance to rock when country music legend Tim Rock brings his Poncho Guitar Tour to Pine Knob Music Theater August 28th. And you could win a pair of premium pavilion tickets, transportation courtesy of MetroCars, and $100 to Buddy's Pizza to enter. All you got to do is download the free WJR mobile app, find the secret keyword, and then text it to 800-859-0957. That's 800-859-0957. More information is available at WJR.com. It's going to be a fun show. Meanwhile, The United Nations-backed Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has adjusted its modeling framework of their global warming outlook. There had been a myriad of analysis and predicting kind of the doomsday scenario of where we were headed. You're talking about the elimination of mass crops, air quality, all of those things. And Donald Trump took to Truth Social after this, bashing the climate change movement, good riddance, that even the IPCC had revised its own predictions on where this was headed. Ross McKittrick is the professor of economics and finance, specializing in environmental economics at the University of Guelph, and joins us this morning to talk about it. Professor, good to have you.
Thanks. Good morning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about first the IPCC and what drove them to their decision to alter where they think climate change was impacting the globe.
Well, there are a couple of elements in climate forecasts. There's the climate model, and there are about 40 of them. That's the physical climate system. And then there are the emission scenarios that feed into them. And that's the part that we're talking about today. There's a library of emission scenarios. They've put out several versions of these over the past 40 years. And the problem with those libraries is they span a wide range. So they're not trying to say we actually forecast this much emissions. We're just going to give you a wide range. But we can look at that range and say, well, how plausible are these over time? And the problem is the range is always way too high. So they've got some low and medium scenarios that are plausible, but they include these extreme high-end scenarios. And they will say it's just for research purposes. We want to look at an extreme case just to test out the models. What happened with the RCP 8.5 scenario, though, is they started describing it as business as usual. So researchers were using it as if it's what's going to happen in the absence of any climate policy. Mm. And that was never true. It was never meant for that purpose. But there have been tens of thousands of studies in academic journals using RCP 8.5 as if it's the expected outcome. And I can guarantee that almost any climate change story your listeners have seen on CNN or wherever they get their news, it's been an RCP 8.5 extreme case dressed up as business as usual. Mm. So this is long overdue from the IPCC to just yank that one out altogether and say we're not going to use it anymore.
Ross, climate models are scientific tools, but they've also become really deeply political. How do you separate legitimate scientific forecasting from like policy-driven interpretation of those forecasts?
Well, unfortunately, the RCP 8.5 scenario did blur that distinction because it began to look like some of the researchers were using it because it gave extreme outcomes. Usually you can tell the difference if the researchers are just upfront about, okay, here's the plausible path and the medium scenario that looks like it matches historical emissions growth. And then if you're interested, we'll show you the extreme upper end of what could happen in a worst case scenario. There are papers like that out there. What I've found, though, is that's become more and more rare. What they do is they'll show you the extreme case up front, and then they'll say, and if you want to see the plausible case, well, it's buried at the back of the paper. And that's where we start to get concerned that, okay, this is crossing over into using the science as a rhetorical tool.
Yeah, so to your point, in the way that they've assessed this, they're creating this wide range, but they have narrowed it. So the range is going to be smaller than before, according to those scientists at the IPCC. And that does that, do you think that will help in evaluating what type of system we're under now, whether we're, I mean, I've seen reports that we're entering a global cooling stage like we were in the 70s again. So, I mean, things are kind of ebbing and flowing. And now with a smaller range, does that put us in a better focus, I guess?
If they really follow through on it, then yes, because what they're now saying is their high emission scenario is not very far off what they used to call their medium emission scenario.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, And those medium emission scenarios, in the papers where they were used, they didn't actually look all that scary. It was, you know, just a moderate warming and some things have to adjust. But if that becomes the norm, you're not going to see these scary climate impact papers anymore, and you won't see the scary headlines. My suspicion, though, is it's going to take some time for this to filter through. There are a lot of people still using RCP 8.5. And one thing I would add is the IPCC people are saying, well, we have to withdraw this because climate policy was so successful, we're now on a different path. And that isn't the case. It was just never a realistic scenario. And global emissions have just continued going up. It's not like global emissions have capped or anything.
Sure.
The policy has tended to just move where the emissions happen. So they've moved out of Western European and North American countries and over to India and China, but the emissions are still happening. So it's not that RCP 8.5 was formerly an accurate scenario, but now it's changed. It was never accurate. It was always an extreme case.
Interesting. Professor Ross McKittrick, thanks so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it. I hope we talk again very soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, you got it. But it's always been the thing that has always been head-scratching to me because, you know, you've got the Greta Thunbergs around the world sailing on a boat instead of taking a plane, when reality, the information has always been faulty to a certain degree.
Yeah.
Not that we're not contributing to global change. We are.
No.
I mean, climate change is factually real. Mm-hmm. It is happening.
Yeah.
Whether it's to the degree that people think it's happening based on the information that's provided is a totally different story.
Like, we're, you know, the world's going to end in
in 6 years.
Yeah, 20.
Yeah, we'll have no crops. Coming up on the other side, is it a bird? It's a plane. Nope, just a drone delivering your hair ties. Coming up next.